So I was scrolling Twitter the other day, and Fonzman's posted a card animation that I think I watched like 10 times consecutively, and it wasn't just because the visuals were great, it was because he used Jitter's new audio feature. Man, it's incredible how one simple feature can unlock so many new use cases and creative opportunities. You can do sound effects like Fonz did, or add voiceovers or background music. Audio is such a powerful way to level up your storytelling and bring life and emotion to your designs, and you can start using the feature today. Just head to dive.club/jitter. That's J-I-T-T-E-R. Okay, now on to the episode.
I think language is a very awkward interface for expressing visual ideas. We don't think that chatting in a Discord bot is the way that that technology is going to become the sort of next great creative tool. My guess is there's going to be some new kind of interface. It's a lot of work to sort of take a visual idea in your head, come up with a set of words to describe it, and then hope that the model sort of manifests it in the way that you're thinking about it. So we're very interested in what are visual ways of expressing visual ideas to these models.
Welcome to Dive Club. My name is Rid, and this is where designers never stop learning. This week's episode is a deep dive into the startup journey because we get to hear from the founder and designer of Visual Electric. Now, if you're not familiar with the tool, it's a new AI image generator and graphic design tool that I use for pretty much everything, including all of the cover photos for the Dive articles. So in this episode, we're gonna get Colin's thoughts on the design process, the landscape for creative tools, advice for first-time design founders, and a lot more, including the first look at Visual Electric's big bet for the future of the company. But first, let's hear a little bit from Colin about how he narrowed in on the original product idea for Visual Electric.
I put up a Twitter thread that started with my story. It was really about my background in design, my inflection points in my career where a new creative tool gave me new powers and new abilities to explore my own imagination. It's made me want to start a company that gave that ability to other people. So it's always been a very personal mission for me. Can I build a product or a creative tool that gives people the ability to think a new set of creative thoughts and to create something that wouldn't have been possible before? So that was the very earliest kind of conception of what Visual Electric was. If you think about what graphic design is fundamentally, the primitives of graphic design, its vector shapes, its typography, its imagery. None of these things are outside of the scope of what AI can do. And so from a technical perspective, it felt like a really great application for graphic design. I mean, graphic design is fundamentally very rational. It is a set of heuristics and rules and underlying grids, and I would say that from my perspective, it felt like it was very compatible with machine learning. In my mind, it made sense that you could teach a computer the sort of fundamentals of what great graphic design is and enable anyone to become a world-class graphic designer.
I want to learn a little bit more about your personal design process because you've designed some really prolific products at Universe, PlaySpace, Dropbox, Facebook. And I sourced some questions, and one of them came from Saleo. And he was curious, now that you're the sole designer and you're executing on your vision and kind of calling all the shots to an extent, what are you doing that's different this time around?
I've worked on a lot of zero to one type products. Even when I was working at bigger companies like Facebook and Dropbox, I always found my way onto the emerging product teams. So, I mean, from my perspective, I worked on a lot of early stage products that ultimately didn't really work. So at Facebook, I was working on a product called Graph Search, which was a natural language search engine that let you type in queries like photos of my friends taken in San Francisco. And it was all heuristic driven. This is pre-transformer model. So it didn't work very well, in other words. I then went on to Dropbox and we worked on Paper, which was super popular within Dropbox, and I think it got some adoption outside of Dropbox, but ultimately didn't really capture the opportunity that I think Notion has really captured. I've had a very humbling career, even though I've gotten to work on some really great projects at some really great companies and amazing teams. I actually haven't really experienced working on an early stage product that worked. And I think that's in part because most early stage products don't work. So it's a it's sort of a numbers game. So I think at the beginning of my career, I was operating from very much from a place of intuition. And I think this is a skill that designers develop probably first in their career is I think you become a designer because you have strong opinions about what looks good and what you like, and you become very good at exploring those ideas and building things that you think are good. But for me, at least, having so many experiences where the products that I was working on or designing didn't actually work really forced me to come to terms with how do I know that the ideas that I have are the right ideas, or if my intuition is the right intuition. And I would say that the biggest takeaway for me has been problem selection. I think designers are really great at execution and coming up with simple solutions to problems and intuitive interfaces. But if you're not solving the right problem, it's really not going to matter that much. So with Visual Electric, we're in a constant state of challenging our own assumptions. We have done a lot of user research. We tried to ship things quickly, build in public, basically always operating with the sort of assumption that we are wrong in some important way, and we don't know what that is exactly, and we need to figure it out.
Can you talk in specifics about how user research functions at Visual Electric, especially as someone who is like founder doing all the design as well?
Yeah, I would say that user research has shown up in two ways for us. There's sort of early market research is one kind of user research where you're going out and talking to potential customers, trying to understand their problems, seeing if there's an opportunity to build a better product. And that type of research has been really valuable for us. From the very beginning, we were going out into the world. We were finding people who we had identified as our target customer, and we were doing long form interviews with them. So we'd spend 30 minutes talking to them about themselves, their job, what tools they work in, getting really specific and granular. And then we would spend 30 minutes showing them prototypes of things that we were designing and getting their feedback on it. So that was kind of the early market research, which we've done a lot of. And specifically, I'll just plug this company, userinterviews.com, has been incredible. It used to be that doing the work of setting up these kinds of studies was a massive effort and would take tons of time and money, and you would have no-shows, and it was just a huge amount of work to get to do that. With userinterviews.com, it's like magic. I literally can put together a profile of who we're looking for, and the next day we can have interviews scheduled to talk to these people. The second kind of research that we've done at Visual Electric that's been really helpful is usability research, where we build the product or a prototype of the product. This is all done async, where we give them a link and we watch them use the product or the prototype, and then we will fix the mistakes that we've discovered or plug any of the holes, and then we will do that again. And we will do this on a sort of every other day cadence, where we design a prototype or we ship a feature, we test it, we watch all the recordings, we make note of everything that we need to fix, we design updates, and we do that again 2 days later, and we can get three of those in a week. And it's incredible how much you can travel in a couple of weeks when you're working this way.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you explore new ideas then? I'm asking because, one, you have like a spatial canvas, which is kind of hard to push very far in Figma. And then you also have so much of the UX tied to the quality of the AI output with what it actually gives you back as a visual asset. So how far are you pushing things in Figma as a designer? And what does that collaboration look like with engineering, especially earlier in the process?
My philosophy is you need to be vision-led, but data-informed. If you don't have a clear vision of where you're going and you're just using research or quantitative data to drive decisions, I think you end up losing control of your own destiny and you start optimizing for user behavior. When I was working at Facebook, I saw how effectively they had leveraged data to improve certain metrics in the product, things like time on site and DAUs and engagement, retention. But I think the long-term effects of that is that Facebook ultimately optimized itself to such an extreme that it was no longer a desirable product for people to use. And I think we saw everybody kind of migrate over to Instagram and TikTok. For me personally, it's not the way I ever wanted to operate a company. I didn't want to just optimize metrics for the sake of optimizing them. And I think there are sort of short-term gains you can get from that, but you end up at a local maximum, or even worse, you end up kind of alienating your users because you've optimized so much. The way that we've always approached product development at Visual Electric, and the way that I've approached my career, is I think you need to have some opinion, some point of view, some change that you're trying to make in the world. And that needs to come from a place that is not about a business objective. It's not about a metric that you're trying to hit. It's a purpose. It's a meaning. It's a why you exist as an organization. And then the way that you get there, the path that you take, you need to be very flexible on. You need to have a very clear purpose, and you need to be very firm and rooted in that. And then you need to be open to exploring a very wide range of paths to get there.
You talk about this idea of informed simplicity, and I'm wondering, is there an example from your process designing Visual Electric, like the product itself, that maybe you could point to as a way to explain what that idea means to you?
Yeah, I think informed simplicity is, you know it when you see it. I think it's a feeling you get when you use a product that has been so well designed and so thoughtfully considered that you look at it and it just seems obvious that it should be that way, that there's no other form that it could take. The best example I can think of is our controls. When you select an image, the sidebar opens up on the right side of the screen, and you have a bunch of tools that you can use to edit that image with AI. Now, when you look at that, you may think, well, of course you have a sidebar. That's what every single creative tool has. And I think that that design pattern is that way because it is the correct solution to that problem. But that did not stop us from trying to find a better solution. We went through, at this point, I would guess 100 different versions of what those controls looked like. And they've been on the top of the screen. They've been on the bottom of the screen. They have been split across two different views. They have been on the right side. They've been tiles. They've been buttons. They've been every possible form that you can imagine. And each one of these tools is, part of why I was so excited about this problem space is that there's a bunch of new UI patterns that we need to figure out for interfacing with AI. AI is this brand new technology that doesn't yet have an established set of patterns. Like when mobile came out and we figured out the poll to refresh, as an example, like that was sort of a native UI pattern that emerged from that new technology. And I think we are very much at that place with AI. Similarly, when the camera was invented, we had to come up with a bunch of mental models and affordances for controlling the camera. We came up with aperture and exposure and focus and framing and panning and zooming, and all of these were concepts that didn't exist before, at least not in that specific way. And now we all understand what those words mean, but we had to invent them and then we had to learn them. So we've been iterating a lot on what are the right interface elements and the right concepts to expose to people so that they can effectively collaborate with AI when they are being creative. And there are a lot of parameters and settings that you could show to somebody. So for example, when you're generating an image, there is something called a scheduler, which is basically a mathematical formula that you use during the diffusion process. And different schedulers result in different image qualities. So we've actually chosen a scheduler for each style on our product. And so when you pick a style, we've optimized that style as much as we can. There's also tools like Make Variations, which is using a process called image to image, which takes the image that you have selected and it basically adds a noise layer on top of that image, and then it generates a new image. And so depending on how much noise you add to the image that you're working with, you will end up with something that is more similar or more different than what you started with. And so we explored a ton of different UI elements, and language is also very important here. So it's not just the sort of UI controls, but it's also what do you call this thing and how do you expose that. And so we came up with the creativity slider, and the creativity slider is this really useful tool where you can basically tell the model how much noise do you want to add to this image when you're creating a variation. And so that was one of those concepts that in our user testing, we found people understood the intent of very well. And you don't actually need to understand what's happening technically under the surface when you're adjusting that. You just need to understand how it's going to affect the output. So we're basically trying to create these mental models and these controls that will take this very complicated foreign technology and make it controllable and directable by creatives for their purposes.
Gotta imagine, like, one of the real challenges with designing the product is figuring out how much to lean into abstractions versus how much you actually want to communicate what the heck is really happening behind the hood. Like, this, it wasn't obvious that you would fall at this point in the spectrum.
Not at all. I would say that that is the majority of the work that we've done over the last couple of years, is trying to identify the right level of abstraction. And there's a real trade-off there, because the more you abstract something, the less control you have over it. And so we needed to make a decision about how much complexity do we expose for the benefit of giving people control versus how simple do we want to make the product for the benefit of being easy to use and intuitive to use. And I don't know that we've nailed it, but I think we've gotten close. But that's a constant state of iteration as well. For example, we have a tool called Detailed Upscale, and there's a bunch of settings that you can expose, and we expose the creativity slider, but we also expose something called a reference slider. Because when you're upscaling an image, you don't want the image to change. You presumably really like the image, you want the image to stay the same, but you just want it to be higher resolution with more detail. So you want to minimize the amount of changes that happen during the upscaling process. And so this sort of adjusting that slider has a big impact on the output. So if it's a photo of a person that you know, you probably want that slider to be at the highest level, because you don't want that to change at all. Even small changes in somebody's face are highly recognizable. But if it's a photo of a landscape, it's okay if it changes a little bit, because it may actually be better if it changes, because it can add more detail, it can hallucinate a little bit more, and it will actually produce a better looking image. So anyway, but that's an example of actually, I think, exposing too much complexity. I think we have both of those sliders in the product right now, and I don't think anybody understands what the difference is between those two things. So we're probably going to remove the reference slider and just have the creativity slider, and that will affect your reference level. It'll adjust multiple parameters, but we're constantly iterating on the sort of abstraction layer.
It's cool to hear you talk, because I know that you always wanted to be a founder. You kind of just needed the right push and timing. And in many ways, all of this new tech really was the push that you needed. You know, you're a couple years in. What are some of the other challenges that maybe a first-time founder wouldn't even realize?
There's a lot of things that you have to navigate and kind of learn on the job. So fundraising, that's something I've never done before. And there's the kind of art and science of fundraising. There's the sales process, the pitching, the storytelling. And then there's also just, how do you structure around? How do you negotiate terms? And also, what is the value of a really high profile investor? What kinds of investors do you want on your cap table? Do you want to go to a large multi-stage fund? There's sort of risks involved in that, because if you have a large multi-stage fund lead your seed stage round and then they don't lead your Series A, that's a negative signal to other investors. And so there's a certain strategic wisdom in raising money from funds that only do the stage of financing that you are currently doing. So raising from seed only funds or Series A only funds. So there's all kinds of things, and you're learning these things in a way that, I mean, you're learning them as you're doing them. And so there's no chance to redo them. So the only opportunity I'll have to benefit from my experience is if I start another company. But you're kind of going through all these experiences, and you're trying not to make any mistakes that are going to be too damaging.
I mean, that long list of unknowns that you were just listing, I think in many ways is the blocker, because I know a lot of designers, you know, designers have no shortage of ideas. It's how do you make that jump to build a viable business? And You mentioned the importance of some early conversations that you had with Greg Rosen. In what ways did he help you think through that business strategy element to Visual Electric?
Yeah, Greg, I have to give Greg a big shout out because he reached out to me, cold emailed me when I was an employee at Dropbox. And it was a short email. He just said, hey, if you're ever thinking about starting a company, let me know. I'd love to invest. And Greg is a investor. He's a partner at Box Group, which is a New York-based venture fund that focuses exclusively on pre-seed investing. And so they make many, many bets on very early stage companies. You can imagine that if your job is to do that stage of investing, you know, you've gotten to that place because you're good at sort of working through the earliest stages of product development and company formation. And Greg has been invaluable as a sort of first filter and sounding board for me thinking through very early nascent ideas. And it's a very kind of delicate stage to have these kinds of conversations because it would be very easy to shoot down any idea at that stage. They're for sure deeply flawed in some series of ways. The question is, are they directionally interesting? Are you even in the right universe? And so that was the most helpful thing that Greg did for me, was help me think through problem selection. And I would say as a designer, I am fascinated by user experience problems. And I am sure other designers can relate to just living their life and going through the world and experiencing things that they look at and they're like, oh, this could be way better. The question though is that better version of that thing a venture scale business? Is it a big enough opportunity? Is there some structural reason why it's not better? That, for example, I would say that, you know, one of the first startups I ever worked for, actually the first startup I ever worked for, it was called Lore, and it was an ed tech company. And we were building a competitor to Blackboard, if anybody remembers that software from school. I'm not sure if it's still used, but it was basically learning management software. And I think this is like probably every college kid's idea for a startup, because we were all using the same terrible software. And so the question you have to ask yourself is, why is the software so bad? And I think in that case, it's because great user experience isn't what is incentivized for that type of software. And it's also a very hard business. There's not a lot of money in education software. So it turns out that the reason Blackboard was successful is because they were very good at selling to universities. And so it was actually a problem of sales more than it was a problem of product design. It's like those kinds of pitfalls where you can see that there could be a way better design solution for this problem. But then you have to really understand all of the context around that. There's also the why now question, which I think is a very important question for at least for me to answer, because I would become fascinated with, oh, there's a huge business problem here. Like another example I'll give is, at one point I became very interested in travel and the software experience around booking travel and planning travel experiences. It just seemed like there was an opportunity there to create something that was better. And I had this whole idea of, can you build a product where you connect locals with people who are visiting that area, and then you can have the locals build travel itineraries, and you can sort of get that sort of local knowledge, and you can tap into all of this latent value that exists where you may live in a place and you understand that all the great restaurants and all the fun things to do in that place, and now you can sort of make money by building itineraries for people. And on the surface, it sounded sort of like an interesting idea, but it turns out that this has been tried several times and has not worked. And the reason it doesn't work is because there's a cultural barrier. And if you are going to some foreign place and some local is planning an itinerary for you, your idea of a fun time and their idea of a fun time could be very different. So you end up needing to have an intermediary anyway. So you end up having to have another travel agent sort of working in the process. And so it kind of defeats the purpose. And so, but anyway, this was an idea that I explored and I got really excited about, and I built a whole pitch deck around it. And I had a bunch of prototypes that I designed, and I started talking to different travel agents, and I was getting very serious about this and thinking about trying to raise money for it. And so I was working with Greg on this idea, and he just did a fantastic job of very kindly and sort of very delicately helping me realize that this was a terrible idea and that I should not do this. But he did it in a way that didn't demotivate me. And I think that's the sort of risk that you run, is like, you don't want to take someone's wind out of their sails by telling them not to do something. But the thing that I think he did observe during that, and he told me this later, was that, you know, one of the things that he looks for when he is talking to founders at the stage is like, what is the trajectory that they're on? Like, how much progress are they making week over week? How motivated are they? How much research are they doing? And so we would have a recurring meeting, and every week I would bring him my updates, and he just saw how much I was doing, how much progress I was making. And so when years later, when I brought him this idea for Visual Electric, it just fit my background, and he believed in that, in the space, enough to want to back me.
I love those stories. And the whole time I have like that adage in my head where it's about first time founders focus on product and second time founders focus on distribution, and like just kind of smiling and nodding, realizing like, yeah, that sounds about right. So you ended up raising a round from Sequoia. And I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about what made that process unique, because it sounds like they were almost pitching you as much as you were pitching them.
One thing I learned is that when you start posting online that you're starting a company, you basically set off a series of tripwires that all of the large venture funds have set up that are crawling the internet for signs of people starting companies. And so that's how I ended up talking to Sequoia. They reached out. But what was very different about Sequoia is that, compared to a lot of other investors that I talked to, was the experience I was used to was I would go to a meeting, I would pitch them, and I would sort of explain what I was doing and how much money I wanted to raise. And then they would tell me that they would get back to me, and then they would get back to me a couple days later. And with Sequoia, when I went to this meeting, they had a pitch deck to show us. And they made the case for why AI and creative tools, and specifically why imagery is the area to focus on. And at this point, Adam and Zach had joined as co-founders. And so the three of us were at the Sequoia office on Sand Hill Road. And Jess Lee was the partner who was meeting with us. And she had actually worked on an infinite canvas product before called Polyvore. And she is specifically focused on AI creative tools within Sequoia. So she had a lot of deep knowledge and sort of expertise in this area. And so she laid out a whole vision for sort of how they were thinking about the space, some of which they've actually published online. They have a few blog posts about generative AI that kind of map this out. And then she very sort of succinctly explained why she thought like imagery was the area to focus on, and what kind of team she was looking for. And I mean, we really sort of fit that description perfectly. I think there's a couple of reasons. One is that to train models requires such a massive amount of data. It's on the order of billions of images is what's required. And so if you think about the type of data that's available at that scale, there's not that many data types. There's basically text, imagery, and video. And the video is harder to train on because it requires larger compute clusters. It's harder to scrape video from the web. It's just a much more expensive type of media to train. Text was already a lot further along, and there's already a lot of big players in that space. So imagery felt like, if you're going to go after creative tools, imagery as compared to 3D, for example, or UI design, or any of these other types of media, like there was just enough of it available. And it's a big enough market, like there's a big enough demand for that type of media that you can build a big business there.
Hey guys, real quick, if you know me, then you know I love products. So I want to take just 30 seconds to tell you about three of my favorites. Now, anytime that I'm designing and building a website, you better believe that I'm gonna use Framer. I made the switch recently and I'm never going back. Now, once it's time to animate my designs and showcase my work, that's when I'm gonna use Jitter. It's like Figma, only for motion design. And every step of the way, I'm gonna be using Raycast constantly. It's the cornerstone of how I use my computer and the way that I stay in flow while I work. Now, I hand-selected Framer, Raycast, and Jitter to partner with me so that I could do these interviews full time. So if you want to show them some love, it would mean a lot. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. I want to hear you talk about some of the more like future looking vision stuff, but really quickly, I want to take a detour and talk about the brand itself. Because I think it's pretty easy nowadays to create just like a good website and brand, something that's clean and beautiful. Whereas I think it's much harder to create something that is just like a little bit polarizing and maybe even makes you a bit uncomfortable at first. And I remember the first time that I went onto the Visual Electric website and you had like the hero animation and the typography and the iconography was very unique. And I did kind of sit there and wrestle with it. And I'm just like, you know, do I like this? And it turns out I do, but that's like such a hard thing to do in design, I think. So can you talk a little bit about your goals for the visual language and maybe give a little bit of a behind the scenes for your creative process?
I think we have to start with the name actually, if we're going to talk about the brand. So the first name of the company was actually not Visual Electric. It was Prism. And I was very proud of myself because I got Prism.ai and I got Prism on Twitter and I was in the process of getting Prism on Instagram. And so
have you sold those already?
Yes, I have.
I bet you have. That's a pretty good domain.
Yeah. I think we sold it for, as far as I know, it's the most that an AI domain has sold for, but I could be wrong. Yeah. That was probably the most profit we've made as a company is when we sold that domain. The name was Prism. And then when we went to go trademark the name, we discovered that Prism is such a crowded space that it's virtually impossible to trademark. And so our entity name is Visual Electric Company. And we came up with that name almost, I don't know, on accident. It was, we were trying to register the business in Delaware and I had an email exchange with the lawyers and I asked for Prism and that wasn't available. I asked for Prism AI, that wasn't available. And it's like, okay, well, what are we going to call this thing? And so I don't even know exactly where it came from, but I sent them Electric Visual Company. And then I followed up and I said, actually, I think Visual Electric Company sounds better because it almost sounds like some sort of old heritage utility Americana brand. Like there's something about it that just like General Electric or something. I don't know. There's just something about it that was appealing. And they're like, great, registered. That's your entity name. And so it was never meant to be the company name. And then when we realized that Prism was not trademarkable, we went on this whole naming process of trying to figure out what to call this thing. And we were very close to calling it Lightform, actually. That was our second choice name. And we own like Lightform.ai now. And we were negotiating to get the .com. And when we started to work on the brand, we hired this company, Manual, which is a agency in San Francisco. And I have been a fanboy of their work since I was in college. Tom Crabtree is the principal designer there, and he used to work at Apple. He worked on the original iPhone launch. He is incredibly talented. He left and started Manual, and my co-founder Adam happened to have a relationship with him. And so we hired them to do our brand identity, and we were kind of in the middle of this naming process. And to be honest, we were leaning more towards Lightform because I think Lightform just fits into the sort of, I don't know, startup name template better. It's short, it's two syllables, it's easy to spell, it's one word. But Tom felt very strongly that we should call it Visual Electric, and he convinced us to stick with that name. And I'm really glad he did, because I'll also share that I guess the source of inspiration for that name was, I am such a visual person and I just love looking at art. I love looking at beautiful photography. And when I look at something that I find just super inspiring, it creates this feeling inside of me that is this like electric, energetic feeling. And so that phrase, Visual Electric, was really describing the sort of emotional response that I have to looking at beautiful things. And so there was like a sort of personal story there. And I think Tom also just thought he felt that it really lent itself to a strong visual identity. Like it just, the name sort of sets it up for an opinionated brand. And he definitely tapped into this sort of heritage kind of mid-century feel, and also really ran with this idea of this like electrical engineering diagramming kind of inspiration. And so they came up with this typeface called Visual Electric Sans, and it has all of these alternate glyphs you can look at the case study on Manuel's website if you want to see all of the, this in detail. You can see all the alternate glyphs, and all of them are, they just feel like they came off of the page of an electrical engineering diagram. And then the eye, obviously it pays off the name, but it also, we, internally we refer to it as the mind's eye. So it's about what you sort of see in your own head. It's the vision that you have that you want to manifest in the world. And so the idea is like we are allowing you to sort of bring to life what you can see in your mind's eye.
Well, I'm grateful that Tom pushed you to visual electric and not light form, because it's way better.
Yeah, I agree.
You know, you didn't just nail the name, though. I also think that you have one of my favorite like brand story mission, like written pieces of content on a startup website. And you know, some of these phrases around like creative tooling being an extension of yourself and more like a musical instrument that you play just really, really resonated with me. And I know you worked with Ellis Hamburger on the brand story. So can you talk a little bit about what that process unlocked for you as a founder?
Yeah, that was a really difficult document to write. And Ellis was really helpful as being a guide in that process. One thing I would say is that, you know, when we launched the product the first time, and it, the positioning that we still have on our website today is, you know, image generation for creatives. And that is a pretty broad positioning statement. And when you have a really broad positioning like that, it becomes harder to do a lot of other things that are sort of downstream from that. So for example, who is your target customer? What is your go-to-market? How do you reach that customer? What story do you want to tell? What features do you want to highlight? What features do you want to build? Like all of these things are kind of downstream from this positioning statement. And part of what made writing that hard is that we were trying to address a very large group of people. And I think that as one takeaway for me has been like, that is now a smell that if it's hard to write those kinds of things, if it's hard to come up with the roadmap, or if it's hard to figure out what exactly you should be building, that is probably because you're not focused enough. It's one of these things that it's so easy to fall into the trap of not being focused enough. Part of it is this sort of dichotomy that I think a founder needs to have, which is you need to hold these sort of things in tension. On the one hand, you need to be have a big vision and very ambitious, going after a huge market. And on the other hand, you need to be incredibly focused, and you need to have the humility to go after what may initially look like a small market. You need to target a very specific customer that has a specific workflow and that you're solving a specific problem for. And so I think that first version of the product that we launched, it was this very sort of high level aspirational, almost like a mission statement. And that document we wrote, I think, is a reflection of that. And Ellis was really great at helping us both write the copy, but also think through the story we want to tell. And I think ultimately what we created has a sort of timelessness for us, because as the company evolves and as we kind of change course, I think that document will be just as true, you know, 10 years from now as it was when we launched. And the point that I think we were making is that we sort of see AI in this historical context of breakthroughs in creative possibilities that were made possible through technology. And so if you think about when the camera was invented, it sort of came after this moment where we had this breakthrough in developing light sensitive materials. And so light sensitive materials was the technological breakthrough. And then the camera was the sort of creative tool that allowed people to then use this technology to be expressive. You could say the same thing was true with the synthesizer. So turning electricity into sound, that was the technology breakthrough that then enabled the synthesizer to be created. And when the synthesizer was created, it created an entirely new art form, a new way of making music. I think we see AI as being an invention of that magnitude, where you have this technology breakthrough where you can now create imagery by describing it in language. And that is going to present a new world of creative possibilities. And so what we're missing from that space is the creative tool or the creative tools that will allow people to effectively wield that technology to tell stories and to explore their own imagination. And I think when we look at the tools that exist today, we don't think that chatting in a Discord bot is the way that that technology is going to become the sort of next great creative tool. It's not going to be the next great movie that was only made possible because somebody, film team of one, now can create a movie. I don't think they're going to make that movie through Discord. My guess is there's going to be some new kind of interface, some new way of abstracting that technology that makes sense for that type of person and fits into the workflow that they have.
I mean, that is my experience. Like, I saw the technology, had FOMO, but Midjourney didn't hook me in. Like, I couldn't buy into Discord and chat UI. But, you know, you talked about the of course moment of having the sidebar on the right. It feels so obvious that I was kind of laughing to myself about all the explorations that you did. Because I'm like, of course there needs to be a sidebar. This is exactly how it should be. Like, that clicked for me immediately, where I'm like, okay, now I can get behind image generation.
I think language is a very awkward interface for expressing visual ideas. And so there's this like very lossy kind of translation layer that happens where you have some idea in your head and then it gets sent through this funnel of language, and then it gets re-instantiated in this model in a visual way. And that sort of funnel, that conduit, is super lossy, and it's also very high effort. It's a lot of work to sort of take a visual idea in your head, come up with a set of words to describe it, and then hope that the model sort of manifests it in the way that you're thinking about it. We're very interested in what are visual ways of expressing visual ideas to these models. And so the part of our thinking around putting everything on an infinite canvas was, can we allow you to work in more visual ways? So that's why we built the collaging tool, which lets you layer images together and then use that collage as a prompt. So you're not even, you know, in that workflow, you never have to write a single word. You're showing the model what you want rather than telling it. That was inspired in part because I think for myself, this is definitely the case. I'm a visual person and I'm a visual thinker. And I think we wanted to create a tool that felt native to that type of person and didn't force you to use a sort of awkward interface, which is language.
When you dream about the future of the creative tooling landscape, what do you believe about where the value will accrue that informs your product strategy?
So when we were like very early on, one of the, at the time, contrarian bets we made was that we did not think training foundation models was the place that startups should be working in. And I think this has basically become consensus now, but early on, I got a lot of rejections from investors because we were not doing any kind of foundation model work. And it wasn't because we didn't have the ability to. I mean, my co-founder, Adam, is a machine learning engineer, among other things, and he has been training models for years. And the cost of training models is definitely coming down, so it wouldn't even have been that expensive. But the reason we didn't do that is because, one, we didn't think we needed to. Like, we just think that we're heading towards a future where there's going to be many foundation models that are available and are going to become increasingly specialized for different purposes. And they'll be available either through open source or an API. And that is itself its own challenge to solve. And it requires a very specific team and skills, and it's very capital intensive, and you need a lot of compute. And we just didn't want to be in the business of trying to compete on that level. We see that as like the sort of electricity layer, if you think about it as a metaphor. Like, those are the electricity companies, and they're providing this new form of power to the world. And what we want to do is we want to build the appliances that are going to go in people's homes. So now you have electricity, and the first thing that you do is you replace all your candles with lights, right? That's the obvious thing to do. Nobody was thinking about the dishwasher or the microwave or the refrigerator when electricity was invented. Those were new kinds of appliances that only made sense in the context of every home is now wired. So we think there's an incredible future and world to explore that is entirely agnostic from the foundation model, and it sits at the sort of application layer. And One, I just think that's the space I'm more suited to play in. I'm not a deeply technical founder. I'm not a machine learning engineer. But it's also, I think, where the value is going to accrue. I think the application layer is where you're going to have the workflows and the relationship with the customer. And the foundation models are going to be increasingly competitive and are going to get cheaper and faster and better. And I mean, we're seeing that happen even since we launched. When we started our company, and like very shortly after Stable Diffusion 1.5 came out, and then Stable Diffusion XL, and now you're seeing models like ImageN3 from Google. And yes, Midjourney is continuing to get better, but I would say that the open source and these like public models are getting closer and closer to Midjourney and other models, not further and further apart. So we're seeing them sort of asymptote. But more broadly, I think that's the space that we want to exist in, is we want to build the sort of application layer and just use whatever the best model is at the time.
Before I let you go, can you give us a glimpse at what you're thinking about the future of Visual Electric and how big is the vision?
Our product has so far been exclusively focused on image generation. I do think that being just an image generator, we've discovered it's not enough. We need to do more than that. And we want to be focused on a specific vertical. So image generation is used in a ton of different verticals. We want to focus in one area specifically. And two, we want to be an end-to-end workflow. We don't want to just be in the sort of concept development stage of the workflow, which is, I think, where a lot of image generation exists today. So given that, we have decided to focus in on graphic design. And when you look at the graphic design market, you have the professional tools like Adobe and Figma, and then you have the consumer tools like Canva. And we don't want to try to replace the professional tools. We don't think that's where the biggest opportunity is. We think there's a lot more people in the world who need graphic design than there are graphic designers. And I think that is a characteristic of AI broadly, which is it increases the accessibility of creative production. So I think the area that we're most interested in exploring is how do we give more people the ability to become professional graphic designers, or at least work at a level that would have been required a professional graphic designer on their own. And so I think Canva has done that historically by building templates and letting you customize those templates with sort of a friendly interface. We think there's an opportunity to leverage AI and to build a product that is a bit more premium, a bit more focused on the enterprise and brands and brand consistency, and having the sort of design that it produces feel inspiring to designers, and not, you know, I don't think designers go to Canva to get inspiration today. There's sort of a good enough bar that I think Canva is hitting, and it's good enough for a lot of consumers. But I think if you're a design focused company, a design focused brand, there's a lot more room there to build a product that I think is higher taste and has a more sophisticated notion of what a brand is. So we are going to be launching a new version of Visual Electric this year that is going to be quite a bit different from the product that we have today. And it's going to be much more of a direct competitor to Canva, but it will be focused on the enterprise. It will be focused on design-focused companies that have a notion of a brand system and brand guidelines and care about producing content that adheres to that brand. We actually are looking for early beta testers of that product. So if you're a designer, if you work at a company that cares about their brand, maybe you're using Canva today, or you're using something like Adobe Express, or maybe you're not. Maybe you're just doing all the work yourself and you wish that more of the company could sort of self-serve and create on-brand content. That's the profile of the type of customer we're looking for. So I would love to chat with you.
If you're listening, what Colin just offered is an amazing opportunity to get in early with one of my favorite products. So head to dive.club/electric to get on their early access list, or you can just find the link in the show notes. Either way, this is one of those opportunities that you probably don't want to miss. Okay, now on to the rest of the episode. It's really exciting, and it makes sense conceptually. You know, I'm someone that exclusively uses Figma. I have a mother-in-law downstairs right now who has used Canva in the past because it's so easy. And it does seem like there is like a little bit of a middle ground there where you don't get a lot of the same benefits of template-based speed when you're using a more professional tool. And yet the templates don't necessarily meet my needs where I specifically decide not to use them. So I'm very excited to see how you take this high-level vision and, you know, boil it down into sequenced opportunities and a product roadmap. It's going to be very fun.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm very excited about it. I think what Figma has done for product development teams, I think there's a similar opportunity to do for brand and marketing teams. I mean, if you think about why was Figma so successful, you could argue that it was a better design tool than Sketch for designers. I think it was 10 times better. I don't think it was. I think it was 10 times better for everyone else who was working on the product design team.
Yeah.
So product managers, product engineers, user researchers, copywriters. So it was really an innovation in collaboration and workflows around the design process. And I think there's a similar opportunity that exists for brands. And so that's the high level vision. That's what we're trying to build.
It makes sense. In a generative world, the product that owns and is able to extrapolate the brand guidelines has a very high ceiling.
Definitely.
Colin, thanks for coming on and sharing a little bit about the journey up to this point and also the vision moving forward. I just freaking love the product that you have already, and I'm so excited about what you're working on, and we appreciate you giving a little behind the scenes today.
Absolutely. Thank you a lot, Rid. It's been awesome.
Hey, it's Rid. Don't forget, if you want to go even deeper, each week I send an email out to over 10,000 designers with bonus resources and key takeaways from these conversations. So head to dive.club/email to sign up. Okay, I'll see you next week.